It's Wednesday, September 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, as Europe grapples with an escalating migrant crisis, we'll talk with our reporter in London.
There is no common asylum or migration policy across Europe, and each of the leaders of the individual European countries appear to be trying to make up the policy ad hoc.
Thai police say fingerprints link a suspect to last month's deadly bombing at a Bangkok shrine, and two female country singers stand up for their gender in a song. It's all ahead. At least 2,000 people are stranded at the main train station in Budapest, Hungary, and this is because authorities have stopped allowing migrants to travel to Germany and Austria without a visa from the European Union. And meanwhile, Eurostar trains traveling between Britain and France were stopped for several hours overnight because of suspicions that illegal migrants were blocking the tracks. I'm joined by reporter Henry Ridgewell, who is at VOA's London Bureau. Henry, at the moment, this crisis has been compared to among the worst in Europe since World War II. How are authorities trying to deal with this?
In a very haphazard and disarrayed manner. There is no common asylum or migration policy across Europe. And each of the leaders of the individual European countries appear to be trying to make up the policy ad hoc to deal with this crisis as it evolves every day. And it is changing every day and seemingly getting worse and worse every day. As you said, 2,000 migrants currently in a standoff with police outside Keleti station. That's Budapest's main station, with trains onwards to Austria and Germany. The migrants demanding that they be let on those trains, chanting freedom, waving the tickets which they have already bought for several hundred euros, many of them very angry that they're being prevented from boarding those trains. So it's an extraordinary situation there in Budapest, one of the flashpoints of the crisis that really stretches across the continent. Another flashpoint is, of course, Greece, one of the countries where the migrants first arrive. Just today, we've had two large ships carrying 4,200 migrants arriving in Piraeus, that's the port of Athens, bringing migrants from the islands, which are closest to Turkey from where the migrants come. Many of those islands are overwhelmed. There is no facilities on those islands to deal with these sorts of numbers. So they are brought to Athens. And from there, Greece normally allows them to travel on, is happy to see the back of them, really. Most of the migrants want to travel further on to Western Europe. Another flashpoint, of course, Italy. Boats continue to depart from the Libyan coastline, heading for the Italian coastline. Tragically, the drownings continue in the Mediterranean, both in Greece and Italy as well. We're seeing numbers of 3,000 people a day arriving on Europe's shores, desperate for a better life, escaping conflict in many cases, in some cases looking for job, looking to escape poverty. The numbers are unprecedented. And at the moment, Europe doesn't have a plan to deal with the crisis.
Well, another flashpoint is closer to you, it seems like, in Calais, between Britain and France. What is the situation there like, and how are British and French authorities, are they cooperating to try to deal with the situation?
They have cooperated. This has been a long-standing problem that has reached a furore a few times over the past couple of decades. Calais has long been a funneling point, being the closest point to cross over to Britain. Many of the migrants, of course, see Britain as having a successful economy. Many of them speak English, and they think that's their best chance for a new life. But their only option is to try and get on a lorry or a car and hide on board, which is obviously dangerous in itself, and get on board a ferry or a train coming over. There are something like 4,000 migrants waiting in Calais and trying their chances every day and every night, trying to hide on these lorries and get on board. And yesterday, Tuesday, there were problems on the Eurostar trains. Those are the fast trains between Paris and London, because it was believed that there were migrants hiding on the roof of some of the trains, that there were migrants on the tracks, that there were other migrants hiding on the lorries. And so we saw several frustrated passengers at both ends of the track, as well as the scenes we see every day of migrants desperately trying to get on board and escape Calais. So yes, as you say, another flashpoint, not one of the biggest, although it has to be said, if you read the British press, they are very sort of virulent against this, and this is a huge issue in every part of Europe, and each country is dealing with it in a different way, and that's creating tensions of its own across the continent. Traditional allies really picking on each other and pointing fingers. For example, David Cameron, the Prime Minister of Britain, has made it clear that Britain won't be accepting more asylum seekers, in contrast to Germany, which has said it is scrapping the EU laws on asylum and it's expecting 800,000 asylum applications this year. Some German officials close to Chancellor Merkel have said that, well, if Britain won't take its fair share, then that could dent relations between Germany and Britain, and Germany may not help Britain in its EU negotiations, which are happening at the moment. So this feeds into the very complex, the very volatile situation across Europe at the moment, a continent that is recovering from economic crisis. Chancellor Merkel of Germany has warned that the migrant crisis could dwarf the crisis we've seen with Greece and the euro, that it could cause problems of a far greater scale than the economic crisis.
Thanks very much, Henry. That's Henry Ridgewell reporting from London. Joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what is the social media reaction like to this, unfolding situation in Europe?
Well, we talked about it a little bit yesterday on our show, hashtag VOA. We had folks that were writing in saying this is what the West gets for having gone into these places and started wars. Other people saying we shouldn't let the migrants come in and work together. It shouldn't be the burden of just one region or one country. But the one thing I find most interesting about social media in relation to the plight of the migrants is how they're using social media. The New York Times did a great article that we talked about, how social media is becoming a great tool for them for communication, for navigation, and as we talked about on the show yesterday, humanizing them as well. We had a tweet from one guy who said, oh, it looks like they're sending out photos and videos of their journey. I guess this means they're people too, kind of sarcastically, but it's true that you think of this group of migrants as a kind of a collective group, but these are individual stories and individual people.
Absolutely.
So that was a big topic on our show yesterday, and I encourage everybody to check that out on voanews.com/#VOA. They can see more about that on that website. Trending also today, the Atlas V rocket. Now, this is a rocket that blasted up from Cape Canaveral, Florida, carrying a military satellite. It's a 21-story tall rocket, and it's setting off a bit of a trend on social media because when it launched early this morning, it sent this beautiful contrail into the sky as it went over the Atlantic. So people sending in photos of the tail of this rocket as it shot off in the beautiful kind of white plume in the early morning sky. It looked especially nice with the sun rising. So a lot of people sharing those photos. So Atlas V is a hashtag that's trending, and Cape Canaveral is also trending as a lot of people talk about that rocket taking off. And then we talked yesterday about Anthony Horowitz, of course, the author of the James Bond books, who got in a bit of trouble by saying that actor Idris Elba was too street to play James Bond. Well, he's issued an apology on Twitter, and actually in an interesting way, he wrote up a little paragraph and attached it as a photo to a tweet. So you can read this whole little paragraph bypassing the 140-character limit. But in part of that, he says, clumsily, I chose the word street as Idris Elba's gritty portrayal of John Luther in the show Luther was in my mind, but I admit it was a poor choice of words. I'm sorry and mortified to have caused any offense. So he's backtracking on what he said yesterday, but still not saying that Idris Elba would make a good James Bond. He said he still thinks another actor would do a better job, but at least backtracking on what he said, some of the comments, and apologizing.
Interesting. Well, James Bond fans and others will just have to wait and see what happens.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. In other news, Thailand's military junta and police are speaking of significant progress in their investigation of last month's bombing of a Bangkok shrine. The explosion left 20 people dead and wounded more than 120 others, many of them Asian visitors. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from Bangkok.
Thai authorities still have not released the names or the nationalities of the two foreign men they have been interrogating in connection with the bombing of a popular Hindu shrine in Bangkok. National Police Lieutenant General Prahut Avornchri says evidence indicates the second suspect, captured Tuesday along the Thai-Cambodian border, has a connection to the fatal attack. He says an analysis of fingerprints confirms the suspect handled a bottle containing explosives retrieved from a Bangkok apartment. The suspect, according to the police general, might be the person who took the bomb out of the room or brought it to the area of the Erawan Shrine. On the same broadcast Wednesday at noon, carried on all channels, an Army TV newscaster, Second Lieutenant Pariya Netrawichian, announced that authorities must be notified by hosts of all foreign guests in the kingdom.
We would like to ask homeowners and owners of hotels, apartments, and accommodation buildings where there are foreigners staying in the accommodation to inform officials at nearest immigration bureau or the local police station within 24 hours. Of the foreigner's arrival at your premises.
Arrest warrants have been issued for 7 people since the August 17th blast, including at least one Turkish man. The military junta running the kingdom since a coup last year has ordered officials not to refer to the bombing as an act of international terrorism or mention any possible links to Turkey or China. There has been speculation that the attack could be a response to Thailand's deportation in July of more than 100 ethnic Uyghurs to China. Western governments and Uyghur rights groups criticized the move, saying those deported could face ill treatment back in China. Following their deportation, violent protests in Istanbul targeted the Thai and Chinese missions. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
How would you like to spend the next 60 days in bed? That's what the European Space Agency is asking 12 men to do, all in the name of science. The first members of this group of a dozen will hit the sack for 2 months, starting September 9th. The bed-in, according to ESA, is a part of the research they're conducting so that they can learn how to stop the wasting effects of spaceflight on the body. Although the experiment may sound like a cozy and relaxing time for the volunteers, ESA says that it will not be as a restful experience as it sounds. This isn't the first bed rest study arranged by the ESA. The space agency held others that were of various lengths and included both men and women. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, 2 women country music singers release a new CD called Start Here. Wednesday was another day of volatility in Asian markets amid ongoing concerns about the weakening Chinese economy. Both Tokyo and Hong Kong ended the day lower. China's benchmark Shanghai Composite Index opened more than 4% lower, but recovered to close down a fraction, suggesting to some of further government intervention. It followed a general global equity slide Tuesday, with indices in New York and London falling 3%. In early trading Wednesday in Europe, stocks are trading mostly in a positive territory. China expert Scott Kennedy of the Washington-based Centers for Strategic and International Studies tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, China at one time was a reliable engine for global growth, but that paradigm has changed.
For a long time, we depended on Chinese growth to be a big consumer of our goods and be the factory floor for the world, but China has slowed down a lot. It's going through a massive transformation, and they've had big problems with their stock market. The devaluation of the renminbi a couple weeks ago left folks spooked. They're not sure that Chinese leaders are good managers of their economy anymore. And so China's obviously a big part of the story, but there's other parts of the global economy where there's significant anxiety, including within the United States, where people are still trying to figure out what the Fed is going to do. And, you know, the U.S. stock market itself has been going up for a long period of time without any significant correction. So I think it's a combination of factors.
The slowdown in the Chinese economy is impacting other countries. A Eurozone economist at Pantheon Macroeconomics said China's problems will impact Germany, Europe's largest and strongest economy. Quote, the slowdown in China will weigh on German manufacturing. This can really be extrapolated to many countries, including the U.S.
To some extent, Germany is probably more exposed because probably a more significant portion of their exports are to China than the United States. The biggest direct effect for China's slowdown come from two types of countries. The first are those countries like Australia and Brazil that have been selling massive amounts of commodities to China, which have fed into their infrastructure development, which would slow down, and that's had a big effect on Australia and Brazil. The other are those economies that compete with China in Southeast Asia and elsewhere. They've been challenged because of the devaluation of the renminbi of about 3 to 4% of late, which could eventually go down even further, depending which way China's overall economy goes. Those two kinds of countries are feeling it much more directly than the U.S. I think for the U.S., it's really psychological and feeds into the other anxieties that we have.
There is a view out there that suggests that even though the manufacturing sector in China is definitely slowing, China's economy is increasingly driven by service sector activity, which still appears healthy. Do you subscribe to that?
I do think that Chinese economy is gradually shifting from one that is primarily based on industry and fixed asset investment to one where services and individual consumption are much more important. But they're still not the primary drivers, even though the proportion of people working in services, the amount of consumption is growing. You know, they still are connected to the industrial economy in one way or another. And if China's industrial economy doesn't find a way to absorb the debt that it's built up, the deleverage, reform state-owned enterprises, that's going to keep China's economy from growing rapidly or, you know, recovering in any sustained sense. So even though that transformation is accurate, China's economy can't escape the challenges that the industrial sector faces.
That's Scott Kennedy of the Centers for Strategic and International Studies. Meanwhile, a U.S. Treasury official reportedly said Tuesday that the United States will press Beijing to better communicate its policies. The official told the French press agency it's important for the communication to be clear and effective across a range of issues. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
This is International Edition. Country singers Matty Marlow and Taye Dye burst onto the scene last year with a song that poked fun at the male-dominated lyrics on country radio. Now their first CD, called Start Here, is out, and their second single is climbing the country airplay charts. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with Country Hits USA host Nikki Strong about Matty and Taye and their rise to stardom.
You might not know what bro country is, but Matty and Taye do, and their first single that went to number one was all about bro country. Nikki, explain to the listeners, first of all, what bro country is and why the song The Girl in a Country Song was such a big hit.
Well, bro country is male-dominated country music where men are centered, and it's all about the guys and what the guys do, what makes the guys bond. It's male-centered country music.
And, you know, it's women tend to be more ornamental to the men in the character.
Yes,
so
yes,
Matty and Taye got a little tired of that.
They did. What was really hilarious is that they were going to a recording session and they were listening to country radio and they started making a checklist. They realized the lyrics were similar and they were like, wait a second. They found that there were a lot of cliches. So they wrote them down. They were like, okay, bare feet, cutoffs, tan lines, tan legs, and definitely a girl. And this smoking hot girl is usually in cutoff jeans with long tan legs, and she's dancing on a tailgate, shaking her moneymaker. And they were like, wow.
Moneymaker being a name for her
derriere,
her rear end.
Exactly. And they thought it would be fun to give this girl a voice in a song. And that's where Girl in a Country Song came into play.
Being a girl in a country song.
went to number one in December of last year.
That's
surprise,
right.
Surprise. And some of the guys, Jason Aldean and Luke Bryan and Blake Shelton and Florida Georgia Line,
Georgia Line
and all these other guys that had been making bro country had to kind of answer to that.
Yes. You know, what's interesting is that Florida Georgia Line, I think it was Bryan, who said, I don't know any girl who wouldn't want to be a girl in a country song, which I thought spoke a lot to the disconnect, the dehumanization of the woman and of the girl. And so I thought it was interesting that his response was very much like, oh.
And see, now, that was so popular, and you're only as good as your last record.
Yes.
And so Maddie and Tay had to come up with a second single.
Yes, yes.
Which Tay Dye, that's her full name,
mm-hmm.
has said, you know, we were trying to write this thing that would be like a girl in country song as part
the pressure,
two.
Right, the pressure.
And they ended up coming up with a very different sounding tune called Fly.
Yes. About, really, which is about perseverance through adversity. And I think when they talked about trying to write another hit and that pressure of following up, and they just threw it out and said, you know what, let's just be honest and let's write something from our hearts and let's write something that's true to us. And that's how Fly came about as well.
All right. Well, you know, if you want to send a tweet to Nikki, you can send one to @VOA_music. You can also listen for Nikki when she hosts Country Hits USA. You can find that on our website, www.voanews.com.
That's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Modern slavery is a blight on humanity and is nearly universally condemned, but it does not exist in a vacuum. Trafficking in persons is often perpetrated by well-organized transnational criminal gangs that ensure smooth operations through bribery. In the process, they destroy not only the lives of people whom they enslave, they degrade entire economies. Slavery doesn't just destroy communities and harm everyday people. It fuels a network of ruthless criminals and armed groups that create insecurity and instability around the world, said David Luna, a senior director in the Office of Anti-Crime Programs at the U.S. State Department's Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs. The societal harms and impacts posed by human trafficking are very real. Corruption helps to fuel it and enriches not only those criminal networks behind today's modern slavery, but also enables corrupt police, customs, judicial, and other security officials who protect traffickers and allow them to carry out their criminal activities. Modern slavery recognizes no borders, and therefore, just as no economy is immune from corruption, no single jurisdiction can solve this problem on its own. To defeat this scourge, the community of nations must begin by making clear to the public how much harm human trafficking causes to communities and educating vulnerable populations about the methods used to ensnare and exploit those they enslave. We must also increase the scrutiny of supply chains where little to none may exist. Governments must adopt the highest standards of accountability and human rights protection and ensure that their suppliers and contractors are held to those standards as well. At the same time, international organizations and companies must enforce policies against human trafficking throughout their supply chains. Mechanisms must be established to report cases of abuse, harassment, or violence, and to identify and protect victims of trafficking. Human trafficking siphons away the human capital potential of communities to build sustainable economic growth in a manner that respects human rights, said Mr. Luna. No person should ever have a price tag attached to their heart and soul, nor be restricted, abused, and violated against their physical integrity and free will.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.